Calling Senate Labor and Commerce to order. It is the 4th of April, and it is 1:32. With us, Senator Stevens, Senator Davis, and myself, Bundy. Going to change the order in which we're hearing bills a little bit to accommodate folks that are here to testify. First, Senator Ellis is with us as well. First, we will hear Senate Bill 311, then 312, followed by Senate Bill 242, House Bill 393, and we will finish with House Bill 394. So with that, Jane, I'm going to have you assume the throne for helping us with questions. Okay. Our first bill is 311. This is a labor and commerce bill that the chairman has brought forward, and we have a athletic commission that addresses boxing and wrestling that in conversations with Rick Urien has just not been used in many, many years. So this is just cleanup legislation that would remove that commission from the statutes that's not being used. It will, there is a connection to 312 that we can get into, but we have Mr. Urien here on 311, the Athletic Commission. I have portrayed it as unused legislation. Is that my portrayal accurate?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rick Urien. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Occupational and Professional Licensing, and your portrayal of the bill is accurate. It's a law that's been on the books for a number of years and been unused, and it's time for it to go away.
Okay. Do we have questions for Mr. Urien? We'll just hold this bill in committee until next hearing and give the committee members a chance in case there's any additional information comes up, but I don't believe there will. If you just stay with us, Mr. Urien. That brings us to Senate Bill 212. That will, it's a concert promoters and athletic event promoter bill. At the outset, let me say that I have a possible conflict in that my son does promote concerts, and I wanted to acknowledge that, and that does give me some more information about concerts than I probably wouldn't have had if he weren't involved. And acknowledge Senator Seekins has joined us. The in discussions about this bill, it became clear to me that there was a need for some consumer protection legislation. The idea of the promoter's license is that if someone chooses to be a promoter and sell advance tickets to an event, whether it's a concert or an athletic event, and then would abscond or disappear or something happened that they were unable to provide the concert, the bond that is called for in this bill would allow the state to at least partially and reimburse consumers who had purchase these advance tickets. I view this as I said, a consumer protection form of legislation, and obviously there is some erratic enforcement of who are promoters now, and there are some licensing fees involved that, of course, would provide some revenue to the state. Let me stop there and ask Mr. Urien to add his views on 212.
312. Senator,
312.
We do license promoters. We license 13 promoters at this time. Our license costs $375 a year. They're required to have a bond, $5,000 bond, or cash deposit. There's been no complaints about, other than one complaint about unenforcement of a person that didn't have a bond was in the business of promoting. But there's been nobody that's lost money. I think there was a big case long before I got here about something that happened in Anchorage that somebody lost a lot of money. But other than that, there's never been a case against the bond. And this bill before you, I know we did a lot of talking about it, and goes expands the promoters into the boxing arena and any event that which you sell tickets in advance. It may be more inclusive than you want to look at.
Questions for Mr. Urien? Senator Seekins.
I see there's exemptions, Mr. Chair.
If it's a nonprofit that is the promoter, they are exempt. If someone, a promoter, wants to do an event in the name of a nonprofit, then the profits indeed have to go to the nonprofit rather than use their name and have a private entity have the majority of the profits.
Excuse my ignorance, but what if this is a university or school-sponsored event? Are they a 501c3?
They're not required to have a business license, though.
But if they are a sponsor of an event, would they be covered under this bill?
I would assume they'd be nonprofit. Mm-hmm. That's the way I would look at it.
Yeah, they're not a 501c3. They're certainly are a nonprofit.
Right. That's why I'm just wondering. Yeah.
Well, that's a question that I can't.
Stating that we have, if they have to be qualified for that status, we may want to take a look at that particular sideboard on the qualification.
Make a note of that, Jane, that we'll ask Department of Law about right. that. And again, it's the first time we've introduced this legislation. We'll set it aside till our next meeting, give members a chance to review it and see if there are additional comments. If there's nothing more for Mr. Urien at this point, we will just set this aside and thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
That brings us to SB 272, mortgage lending. We have had previous testimony on this. We do have a CS, and I, because we've had previous testimony and discussion, I'd like to limit testimony to a minute so that we can get to the rest of our calendar. Senator Seekins, if we could have a motion to adopt.
I'd move that we adopt as our working document CS for Senate Bill 272, the work draft that is titled, identified in the upper hand corner as / P for Papa.
P would be our working document without objection. And we have representative from the bill sponsor, if you would.
Thank you.
For the record, please.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Amy Seitz, staff to Senator Wagner, who sponsored Senate Bill 272. And I will go through the changes, which are much fewer than the last changes we had to this bill.
Thank you.
The first one is found on page 5 of the P version, and that's adding the Department of Law to who is able to collect on bonds. That was an oversight that we had missed on the last one. Also, Terry Bannister, our legal drafter, pointed out a few things that we needed to clarify in this bill. So most of the changes are on that memo, or about that memo. The first one, she found reference to assessment twice in this bill, and we had no other reference explaining what assessments were, so we changed that. On page 5, the last line, we deleted assessment and added investigative costs, since we deal with investigative costs in the bill. On page 7, Terry pointed out that we had no means to renew a license, so we put in a way for a person to renew their license every year, and then added a new section that deals with the transfer of a license. Then on page 10, Terry Bannister pointed out that in the disqualified persons, there was some contradiction between subsection A of 270 and B and C. So we deleted where it mentioned a shareholder in A, since they're dealt with in B and C. And then on page 11, in the last CS, section 280 was inadvertently left in, so we deleted that and renumbered the bill according. And also on page 11 was the second place she found assessment, and we replaced that with costs on line 16. On page 13, in the last CS, we had meant to delete the old subsection A, so we took care of that in this one, so there's only one paragraph in 350. And then on page 14, that was in Ontario Bannister's memo number 5. We added in language specifying who the persons are covered under 420. And the last one on page 18, this was some clarification language requested by the Department of Law. It had the word enforcement in there, and they were worried that by having that word, the Department of Law wasn't meant to enforce. They just wanted to exercise the rights of this chapter. So those were the changes. Roger Prince is online if there are any questions on the CS, and Ken Gain is also online to answer any questions from the mortgage lending industry.
Okay, questions for the sponsor? I'm just looking for the original bill. Was it originally referred also to Judiciary?
No.
No, Mr. Chairman, it was referred to Finance.
Okay. Well, we have in our packets a memorandum from Terry Bannister with a question about interstate commerce.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that if out-of-state companies and in-state companies are treated the same, there's not that issue, and Roger Prince could go into more detail if you wanted on that.
Okay, well, we'll ask that if it might necessitate a judiciary hearing or referral. Okay, if there aren't any questions for the bill sponsor, let's go to testimony. Mr. Prince?
Yes, Senator.
You heard my question about the interstate commerce concern that Teresa Bannister brought up?
Yes, I did. And this is Roger Prince, Financial Institution Examiner for the Division of Banking. Mark Davis asked me to step in today because he is unable to attend. And in reference to the interstate commerce concerns, the as long as the Division of Banking and the law itself, this Senate Bill 272, treats interstate and out-of-state companies identical in their treatment under the law, there is no violation of interstate commerce or clauses. Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law, Consumer Protection Division, last year wrote a letter regarding the Payday Loan Act that covered the same concerns regarding the enforcement of the Payday Loan Act or the Deferred Deposit Advance Act against both in-state and out-of-state companies as well as online companies. And there is a long review that he did, and basically as long as the businesses are treated equally, there's no violations regarding interstate commerce.
And in your opinion, in this bill, in-state and out-of-state companies are treated equally?
Correct.
All right, thank you. Questions for Mr. Prince on the bill? If you'd stay with us, Mr. Prince, we don't have questions right now, but some might come up.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay, moving then to Lori Holt.
Finance Corporation. I don't have a lot of new comments other we've had a chance to review the draft before the one that you've got in front of you, but listening to the comments, there doesn't appear to be anything substantial that we would find any objection with, and we just want to say that we do agree with this proposal and recommend it.
Okay, thank you. Just once more for the record, we missed your name. Would you identify yourself for the record again?
Laurie Holte.
All right, thank you, Laurie.
Thank you.
And I see no questions. Thank you for being with us. Ken Gain?
Yes, Senator, this is Ken Gain. I'm with the Independent Lenders of Alaska. I've previously testified on the substance of the bill. Primarily today, I just wanted to be available for questions and to state that I have reviewed the draft you have before you. We consider the changes administrative and technical just to clarify issues. We believe that the substance has not been changed and that this is still a good bill, and we urge passage.
All right, thank you. And I see no questions. Kevin Breland?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead with your testimony, please.
This is Kevin Breland, president of Alaska Mortgage Bankers Association, minority partner with Residential Mortgage in Anchorage, Alaska. I've reviewed the changes to this bill as well, Mr. Chairman, and I find them to be acceptable, and Alaska Mortgage Bankers supports the bill and urges a passage of it at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. That'll take us to Joe Brammer.
Metropolitan Mortgage here in Anchorage, and I serve on the legislative board of the Alaska Association of Mortgage Brokers. We've been working a long time for this bill, and we feel that passage of this bill is imminent. It has been said in previous public testimony that it's better to pass something than nothing, and although this is not a perfect bill, we've been working on a lot of these committee substitutes to get it as close to perfect as possible. A couple points of clarification. At the last public hearing on Thursday, we had been told that the program administration fee is outlined in Section 06600 would be applicable to all mortgage loan instruments recorded, and that we would receive clarification on that to those folks that are exempt in 020 would still be required to charge the applicable $10 fee. We had made a suggestion that this fee may be made negotiable to be paid by the buyer or the seller in the transaction, as we are uncertain if it does comply with HUD guidelines. The final comment that I have is, I believe, as I had previously testified before the House, that the exemptions are fine. A lot of these are going to be regulated by the feds, but we do need to have all of those parties who believe they are exempt to apply for the exemption and pay an annual fee, much like the model legislation that we see in Nevada. This way, it will ensure that we have a full list of all the players. Secondly, it will make certain that nobody slides through the cracks in believing that they are exempt, and then harm is done to the consumer, and it's too late to correct it. So other than that, on behalf of the Alaska Association of Mortgage Brokers and myself, we feel that with some minor revisions, this is a great piece of legislation, and we would urge its passage.
All right, thank you. Amy, you've heard his concerns about the revisions. Have they been discussed by the bill sponsor?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Amy Seitz, and I had not heard, I don't believe, but I will.
Yeah. Is there, can you, on the sponsor's behalf, give us the assurance that those concerns would be addressed in the next committee or referral?
On the sponsor's behalf, Mr. Chairman, I will give you my word that we will look into that.
Okay. We'll bring around the knife for the blood oath a little later, and we'll move us to John Martin, please.
Hello, Mr. Senator. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
Okay. This is John Martin in Anchorage. I've testified before you before several times on this issue. I have submitted written testimony, but I want to go over a few things verbally. I question the need to designate a mortgage broker as a financial institution, since they are not a depository organization and do not have a depository relationship with their clients. It seems kind of odd that that would happen. Under Section 06.60.010, I would add the language regarding residential property to clearly indicate what transactions are to be covered by the license and will be a concern of the licensee. I believe it will bring into focus a lot clearer on this legislation. On Section 0660.25 would require an independent contractor to obtain a license. Why would we let somebody be responsible for the independent contractor, especially when the independent contractor must agree to abide by the requirements of the chapter anyway? Doesn't make a lot of sense. So it does make sense to delete this exemption and let them be licensed as a true independent contractor, as they may work for more than one entity. On sections .040-50 and section 210, 12 AAC administers the licensing fees, and a review of the administrative code shows approximately 36 licenses that it controls. And when you look at that, it reveals that the licenses are issued on a biennial basis, not an annual basis, so they'd be good for 2 years. And I would recommend the same for this license. Also, the initial fee for most licenses is $50. And the majority of license fees are under $300. So I would recommend that we adopt the same figures for our licensing purposes. Also, in October 2005 of Mortgage Originator magazine shows that background checks vary from $10 to $125. And I would cap this fee at $125 level, with the balance to be refunded to the licensee if not used. I mean, why take their money if you're not going to use it? On Section 070, I would recommend that the department issue a license within 30 days rather than 90. A person would waste clearly a quarter of a year waiting around to be licensed to try and earn money, and I don't think that's fair to the licensee or the general public. Section 250B, loan files are two or more inches thick. I think the department needs to clarify exactly which forms or what information they want retained. I don't think it's proper for them to have every single piece of paper. And there may be privacy issues here that we have to deal with the FTC. So I'd like that investigated as well. On Section 250C and D, I would combine these two paragraphs into one and have both entities accountable on the same level. On Section 610B, I find it convenient that the department is going to mandate a $10 fee, but they're not going to be responsible or liable for an agent's defalcation. That's pretty interesting. There should be some recourse there. But biggest thing, the biggest component of all that's missing on this bill is licensing of originators, and there's no mention of it here, and that's where 98% of the problem comes from in this business. Now, I'd like to let you know that I just received the new CSP just at lunchtime, have not had an opportunity to review it, and would like to be able to submit the written comments to you on that later today or tomorrow or at your next meeting. That's all I have at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. What I would ask that after you review it, if you would submit your written comments to Senator Wagner.
Okay, I can do that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 272? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Any amendments from the committee? Seeing none, the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, just checking. I'd move CS for Senate Bill 272 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Jane?
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Ellis?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes, and with the assurance that these questions will be addressed in finance.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. That brings us to House Bill 393, colon cancer screening. And do we have someone from Representative Anderson's office here? We do have someone from Representative Anderson. Good afternoon.
My apologies, Senator. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Heath Laird. I'm staff to Representative Anderson. I'm here back before you. I believe you. We are discussing HB 393, the colorectal cancer screening bill. My understanding is that my colleague, Ms. Devonti, did quite a good job last time explaining the bill. We are back here today. There was some discussion or some concern with regard to the fiscal note that was presented from the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Since that time, Representative Anderson's office, myself specifically, and Division of Insurance and Retirement and Benefits have been in discussion. We sought out a legal opinion from Legislative Legal and shared that opinion with both the Division of Insurance and Retirement and Benefits, and as a result of those discussions, I believe you should have before you today a revised fiscal note. I would be very happy to discuss the specifics of the policy again if the committee would like me to do that. However, I would prefer to defer some of the questions with regard to the fiscal note to Ms. Milhorn, or I believe Ms. Hall is also in the audience as well. So whatever the committee's wishes are.
Okay. Questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none. Linda, did you care to comment, or were you just here for questions? Okay. Melanie, would you join us, please? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Bundy, committee members, for the record, my name is Melanie Milhorn, and I'm the director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And I wanted to provide you first with just a little bit of background on the Alaska care plans, and then I would like to segue into why our fiscal note first reflected that was a mandated coverage for the retiree plan, followed by a revised fiscal note that indicates that it does not have a cost to our retiree health plans. So we administer two health plans. There's the active plan and there's the retiree plan. We became self-insured in 1997. The governing authority for both of those plans is found in Alaska Statute 3930090. The active plan covers approximately 5,300 active employees and 8,900 dependents for a total of 14,400 active lives. The retiree plan covers or provides system-paid health care coverage for PERS, TERS, JERS, and EPORS members. We cover approximately 29,300 retirees, and their dependent number is 24,700 for a total of 54,000 retirees. The Commissioner of Administration has the authority to make changes to both our active and our retiree plan. That's found in Alaska Statute 3930090 through 095. The division has not taken a formal position on the policy aspect of Committee Substitute House Bill 393. However, I believe all parties can agree that preventative services are in the best interests of employees and their families. Preventative services can also be beneficial to plans. When you have those services provided, it can reduce costs to a plan that, if later stages of disease are found, are more costly to a plan. Quantifying those costs is not an easy, is challenging, obviously. In order to prepare for the very first hearing regarding this matter, the division was under the erroneous assumption that these the colorectal cancer screening would be mandated coverage for the retiree plan in accordance with Alaska Statute 2142. However, we further had discussions with Division of Insurance, Linda Hall, Director, and our Department of Law, and those colorectal cancer screening is not a mandated coverage, and we are not regulated under the Division of Insurance. So, therefore, there would not be an impact to our active plan or our retiree plan. Under our active plan, we cover preventative services such as colorectal cancer screening, and if a physician requests that those testings be done, as long as it's within 90 days of an annual exam, all of the provisions under this bill would be covered under the active plan. We do not cover preventative services for the retiree plan, with the exception of those found in Alaska Statute 2142, which is the PSA testing, mammograms, and pap smears. Those were coverages that are under our retiree plan, but the Commissioner of Administration had, on a voluntary basis, amended our plan to include those preventative coverages. So I'm hoping that you have a copy of our amended fiscal note, and I would answer any questions that you might have.
Questions for Melanie? For the colorectal screening then to be included in retirees would be, the process would be to go through the Commissioner of Administration, who then would have the authority to make the same decision he made on breast cancer screening.
Chair Bundy, that is correct.
And someone on the other side of 50, I can see perhaps that is intuitively wise, but we'll leave that to his decision then. Okay, further questions for Melanie? If not, thank you for being here. We do have Emily Neon on line for testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Bundy. This is Emily Neenan with the American Cancer Society, and I was just going to be available if there were any questions that came up. I appreciate the committee taking my testimony of the last time around.
Okay, thank you very much, Emily. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 393? Hearing none, we close public testimony. I see no amendments. What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekins.
I'd move Senate House Bill 393 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached revised fiscal note.
Okay.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Ellis?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. 393 is on its way, and that brings us to 394, our first time we've heard this bill. It is act relating to insurance policies in foreign languages, and I thought all insurance policies were written in a foreign language.
They are, Mr. Chairman.
That was a little Division of Insurance humor. Very little, she would say.
You got a lot of laughs out of the back row.
You should always laugh at the chairman's jokes.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Michael Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer, who had to go back to finance, and he apologizes that he couldn't be here today. House Bill 394 is based on the idea that, according to the last census, more than 80,000 Alaskans speak a language other than English at home. And though these Alaskans are still required to purchase insurance, there is an obstacle in state law to a company providing them with associated materials or policies that are published in a foreign language. The problem is that since the law is silent on which version of a policy, be it the non-English version or the English version, is the official version, and since insurance contracts and policies are interpreted against the insurance company with all of the associated materials brought in, and since no translation is ever perfect and there can be plenty of disagreement in court as to the nuances of a word, companies are reluctant to publish policies, pamphlets, materials in a language other than English. This has led to a growing portion of our population not being adequately served. As the chairman said, insurance policies are hard enough to understand in our own language. And to ask someone to wade through the minutiae of a contract without supporting materials for informational purposes, it is detrimental to them trying to conduct regular business in the state of Alaska. So the sponsor introduced House Bill 394 to remove that obstacle from statute, put adequate barriers in to prevent misrepresentation of information, and to clarify that these are to be only for informational purposes. And he believes that this will lead to a freer market in the state to conduct business and serve Alaskans that truly need the service. Mr. Chairman, that is in essence the bill, and we have representatives from the insurance industry and the Division of Insurance here to answer questions if there are any.
Yeah. And I've been here long enough not to assume anything. I assume this does not require someone to try to provide written information in a language that does not lend itself to
Mr. Chairman,
the written
always
form.
Always a good question, and no, it requires nothing of anyone. It only removes an obstacle to allow people and companies to pursue a business activity that they might want to.
Thank you. Questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Seekins.
I have a question. On page 2, starting with line 6, an insurer may not misrepresent information in an insurance policy form or associated material translated into a language other than English. So he can only misrepresent in English?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, that's actually a good question, but covered under the same section of law where we took this language from, which is 2136.030, which is misrepresentation and false advertising. And so the actual activity in English is covered under a separate statute.
I'm just curious. It appeared to me that...
That sounded like a used car loophole to me.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Other questions? We do have some folks here to... testify. Jeffrey Trout. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeffrey Trout. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance. I primarily would like to just answer questions, but I would like to make a couple comments and just expound on some of the issues raised here. Number one, we don't, at least so far, we have not gotten many policies, people submitting policies to us for approval. I believe we've gotten two so far. Two, if I recall correctly, they were health insurance and they were in Spanish. And an English translation was sent along with it. We would regard that, under that circumstance, I'd probably regard the Spanish version as the operative version. Which is fine, but I know enough Spanish to know that everybody knows what seguro de vida means, life insurance. But there's other business phrases and things like that that mean one thing in Mexico, maybe mean another thing in Chile and or El Salvador. And so there, it's good to have an anchor so that everybody sort of knows what version you're working on. I also see this particular bill as a consumer protection bill. I think as was pointed out, it's hard enough to understand insurance documents in English if you're not a native speaker of English, you're not likely to, because they're pretty complicated, and the you have to do some ling- you have to do a little bit of linguistic gymnastics to understand them sometimes. So consequently, anything that would encourage insurance companies to provide materials in a form that people understand is a good thing. I see it as consumer protection, and I see it as consumer education, and consequently, I'd be in support of this. I'd also, if I could, expound on Senator Sekin's point. To me, I believe a lie is a lie, whether it's in English, Spanish, Tagalog, or Mandarin. I would apply Section 2136, 120, and 40 against anybody, whether no matter what language they're lying in. But even though I believe those two statutes apply to a misrepresentation in a foreign language, as somebody who works in enforcement, I don't mind you giving me a little extra rope to hang the bad guys with.
And the bottom line is the division supports the legislation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Okay.
And Sheldon Winters, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sheldon Winters. I represent State Farm Insurance Companies. State Farm is the largest insurer of homes and autos in the United States and in Alaska. We'd like to thank the sponsor of this bill and as well as the sponsor of the Senate companion version, Senate Bill 280, which is Senator Huggins. This is one of those win-win bills. The industry supports it. We support it because we think we can better serve our customers by providing meaningful information to them and thus a better product, and allows us to tap into that market. The division supports this bill because it's a benefit to the consumer. In today's society, insurance permeates everything, as we all know. We mandate auto insurance to drive a car. To own a home, you have to have insurance. Rent, you probably have to have insurance. Run a business, you get insurance. What we simply want to do is provide meaningful information to those folks that don't speak English. So the question might be, why do we need this bill? Well, there's two aspects of the bill, and the first deals with the actual insurance policy forms that get filed with the division. As Mr. Trout indicated, if there's a non-English version filed with the division, there is no law as to which version controls. And in fact, I think it's my understanding that the division has sort of unofficially assumed that the non-English version would control, and we want to clarify that the English version would control if the two requirements are met. One, both versions are filed, and two, both versions, non-English and English, provide the notice to the consumer that this is for informational purposes and the English version controls. Secondly, and probably most pertinent to what we want to do, at least more immediately, is providing informational materials, brochures, describing what type of coverages are there, what type of product the consumer has available. And again, that's virtually impossible if the consumer doesn't speak English. The problem in doing this lies with court interpretation of such materials and the inherent subtle differences between an English version and a non-English version. In Alaska, as with virtually every other state, our Supreme Court has ruled if there's a dispute about what a policy provides, the court is not only going to look at the actual policy language, but any other extrinsic evidence that the consumer may have looked at or relied on. That would include the advertising or the brochure or the informational materials that we want to produce to these folks. That's all fine and dandy when everything's in English. It's this dilemma of what happens when there's a non-English version out there. And what we find is that in the other jurisdictions that allow policies and advertising material to be produced in a non-English version, we find that the insurance companies are producing much more information out there. California is a great example, and I wish I'd brought these brochures, but I forgot them. There are a lot of informational brochures in all sorts of languages out there because they have a law in the books that says exactly what we're trying to do here. You can provide this information, and so long as you do it in good faith, basically, and you provide both versions and the disclaimer that the English version controls, which I think demonstrates the need for this bill. I think there's 12 other states that have done this, and this is a trend that's going on right now. I think, for example, South Carolina has got legislation going that they're trying to pass. I should note briefly that this bill is more restrictive than other states. Most of the other states don't require an English and a non-English version to be produced. In other words, a lot of the states just allow you to go out and produce Spanish material without the English version. And some of the states don't even actually require the disclaimer or the notice that the English version controls. And we provided that here in this bill, and we think it works well for the consumer. So in closing, we think there's a need for this, both for the industry and the consumer, supported by the industry, supported by the Division of Insurance. It's a growing trend in other states. We've heard no concerns or opposition expressed in the other chamber, and we'd ask that you consider this and pass this legislation out. I can answer any questions if, or try to anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. And I see no questions, so thank you very much for being here.
Sir.
Is there anyone else like to testify on House Bill 394? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. This seems to be a relatively simple and non-controversial bill. If the committee's comfortable with moving it the first time we've heard it, the chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 394 from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note.
Jane?
Senator Ellis?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. We will not have a meeting Thursday. Finance is meeting Thursday afternoon, beginning work on the operating budget and doing some PPT work. So I think we've taken care of most of our business, and we're pretty well up to date. Likely we will meet again a week from today, but Jane will be sending out notices for our next meeting. So with that, thank you for everyone, and we'll stand adjourned at 2:20.